Hello and welcome to Life Sentences. I'm Caroline Baum. At just 26, you'd think there's not enough to say about tennis champion Naomi Osaka to deserve a biography, but you'd be wrong, as Ben Rothenberg proves. Osaka's story is emblematic in several ways. It ticks many boxes as a story of family aspiration, diversity, digital nativism, mental health, and more. You realise, reading this very detailed account of the life of an elite athlete, that what you see on court is a fraction of the fuller narrative of the circuit, the rankings, the pressures, the sponsors, the relationships with other players, the role of fans, and especially in Osaka's case, the media. Naomi Osaka did not make it through to the finals of this year's Australian Open, but I spoke to Ben Rothenberg while he was out here for the tournament. He speaks almost as fast as she serves. Ben, welcome to Life Sentences.
Thank you for having me, Caroline.
When did this book first become an idea?
I first had the idea to do the book actually on a very specific date. It was the day on which Naomi decided to stop play in New York in 2020, when she had been kind of finding her voice a bit on social media on causes of activism and Black Lives Matter a lot during the pandemic stoppage. That had been a really prominent time in her life in terms of developing, in terms of finding herself, finding out what her life was like outside of tennis when the pandemic suddenly shut the tour down, and what she prioritized in her world. And yeah, it was on that day actually that I have notes of myself first mentioning it to her agent, actually, I was talking to, because I was talking to him just on background about the stoppage in New York. As people don't know, there had been this most recent police shooting that happened in the U.S. in Wisconsin. A man named Jacob Blake was shot there, and there had been an NBA team from Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Bucks, had decided to stop play for that day, and then several more NBA teams followed their lead. And then Naomi, seeing this, followed their lead. She was the one individual who stood up and really got the tournament to grind to a halt by herself. And just knowing the incredibly shy person she had been since I first met her as a teenager, it was that sort of transformation that made me really fascinated by her. And then over the next couple of weeks, that only strengthened, because she won the US Open wearing these seven masks of the seven names of victims of various violence as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And she became even more interesting to me. I started doing research on her and her family, seeing what I could find on various Google deep dives, and already found a lot of things I didn't know and that hadn't been reported previously, and that made me curious to learn more. So it was a little while longer till the book actually started getting written, but that was the germination of the idea for sure.
So how long had you been watching her on the circuit at that stage? Because you are a tennis writer, and obviously you're looking at young talent coming up all the time, and presumably you're thinking that person might be interesting to follow.
Yeah, I had known the name since actually a friend of mine who was at a tournament that she made her debut at in California had been at her first press conference and was really struck by her personality and her combination of shyness and audacity. That was in 2014. So I had known the name for about 6 years. And then I first met her a couple years after that in 2016, actually in Melbourne. It was her first Grand Slam tournament she played in the main draw of. And I did a profile of her for the New York Times then. And that was the first time I met her and spoke to her and spoke to her father as well. And yeah, that was the first time I'd seen her. But then she had been kind of almost like a sort of indie darling or underground favorite of a lot of the tennis writers, because she had this powerful game and this really quirky, different personality that made a lot of people who were sort of tennis nerds follow her even before she had the ranking to really justify it. And she always had this big Japanese press contingent following her as well, because it's a very ardent country with a lot of media and not a lot of tennis players. So she got a pretty outsized focus from a young age among the Japanese press. And yeah, so that was sort of, it was seeing her, having known her back when, seeing her emerge into the sort of mainstream media figure over time.
So we're going to come back to the question of Japan and her Japanese identity in a moment. But once you decided that you wanted to write a book about her, was it easy to get access to her and to get her to agree to whatever the terms were between you and to give you time? Can you just talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so that wasn't something I was totally sure what would be. I've been mostly corresponding with her agent during this time, and he was always supportive of it. And I've known him for a while, back before she was on tour even. And yeah, it was interesting because she was at once both very open and also wanted to be a bit arm's length at times. We didn't have really any like extended sit down, long heart to heart interviews about opening up with everything and really open ended stuff. She wanted to keep some distance from that. I think also her previous agency, I think when she was with IMG at the time when the book idea first started, I think they had wanted, you know, just as a so many athletes and celebrities more generally, but especially athletes control so much of their own content and media now, and they have their own. She already had her own documentary once already, Naomi did. So they wanted to kind of not give away her story completely, I think was maybe part of the thinking from her and her family and her agency back then, as I said. But I traveled the tour shadowing her in 2022, the entire season, or that was the plan to do most of all the season. She wound up having a very sporadic year on tour and pulling out a bunch of tournaments and things. But every time I had a question for her in any setting, she was always very open and revealing and would begin to talk about whatever. You know, we could spend time talking about something that happened in 2013, you know, which we did at least once I can remember, after a match in Miami. And she was never withholding or cagey or anything like that once actually she started talking.
And did that mean that she got to see the manuscript before it was published? And did she ask for anything to be removed? Did she have any kind of editorial veto?
No, which was important to me as a journalist. She had no editorial veto. So there's this binary, as you know, in biographies between authorized and unauthorized. And this book doesn't fit cleanly into either side of it because it's definitely not authorized in a traditional sense, because it was my idea to do the book, not hers. She didn't have any editorial control or veto power over it at all, nor did anyone, her team or family, on that sense. But nor was it what people think of as unauthorized, where it was like adversarial or anything they were against or antagonistic to. Actually, one of the biggest things for her cooperation with the book is at the very end, or, you know, about a month ago, she sat down and went through a whole long list of fact-checking things, which I was hugely appreciative of, and, you know, confirming probably 95% of them and sort of clarifying the other 5% about the things didn't happen exactly how other people had told me they did. So that was hugely appreciated. And that was something that she and her team definitely understood the value of doing on their end to make sure everything was as accurate as possible. So yeah, definitely grateful to her. And, you know, I had known her for so long and, like I said, talked to her in lots of contexts. I didn't feel like I was really missing anything too much on access on her side, particularly that made it a book harder to write. I feel like I kind of got everything I needed and a lot more from her, because when she does talk, as I said, she's remarkably open. Yeah.
Yeah, she is. We'll come to that. Let's start, though, with a clarification about her name, because when I've been talking to people in the last couple of days about the fact that I'm going to be talking to you about her, people say, is that her real name? And does she really come from Osaka? So can you just clear that up?
Yes. So that is her real name. So her mother's name, or her mother was born in a small town in the very northeast corner of Japan called Nemuro. Her mother's name is Tamaki Osaka, or actually in Japan, they say the last name first would be Osaka Tamaki. But it's her name actually. And there's a slightly different character of the A in their last name, in the middle A, in the, you know, third letter of the name, than there is in the city. So slightly, not exactly the same word in Japanese, but very, very similar, but pronounced the same even by Japanese people largely. It's not a meaningful difference in the spelling there. It's almost as if you had Melbourne, let's say, without the O or something, it'd be kind of pronounced the same. So that is their name. And then when their daughters were born, so Tamaki married a Haitian man named Leonard Francois. And when their daughters were born in Japan, they said basically they gave their daughters the mother's last name just because it's not easy often walking around and being in Japanese society with a foreign name. Having a Japanese name for being, you know, normal part of society is just a lot easier than Francois, which I thought they thought would be cumbersome. So some people wondered if it was like a branding exercise to give her this hometown. And no, so it was authentically her mother's last name. And they did say, her mother did say that she wanted to give both her daughters, her sister's name, Mari, M-A-R-I, her older name is older sister, wanted to give them names that could be pronounced easily by people in other cultures as well. So these are both, they're obviously much more intimidating Japanese names to people outside Japan than Naomi Osaka. Because Osaka, anyone who's heard of the city, which is a big world city, will be able to feel like they can grasp very quickly.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about the family background and about the dynamic between the two sisters.
Yeah, so these two sisters, who were about 18 months apart, were born in Osaka as their parents lived there and moved and started playing tennis actually while they were still in Japan, or at least Mari did when she was old enough to be playing. And now they played a little bit in Japan as well. And they moved to their parents, their father especially, but both their parents had this dream of having them be tennis stars after watching Venus and Serena Williams win a doubles title at the 1999 French Open, when the Williamses were still teenagers themselves, actually. And they saw this on TV and said, hey, I have these two daughters as well. They could be like these, you know, young women I see on TV. Why not? And they really went all in on this very long shot idea of seeing what they saw on TV and thinking they could replicate it. So they moved to the U.S. in part for tennis, in part because that's where Leonard was already from, and his family, his Haitian American family, had emigrated to Long Island, just outside New York City. And so they moved there and started training tennis intensively. And then they started moving, and then they moved eventually, very suddenly, to Florida, which is the tennis hotbed or hothouse, if you want to say, of the U.S. and actually of the world. A lot of people from all over Europe, certainly in Asia, moved to Florida, to a lot of the various elite academies for developing tennis talent they have in South Florida. So they moved there, and the daughters had a very focused tunnel vision kind of upbringing just around tennis. They were pulled out of normal schools. They did online homeschooling each day after spending hours in the morning and afternoon on the court. And that was their whole childhood. And it was very isolated in a lot of ways. They didn't see many other people. Mari said, I think, something like, I knew three people in my life, and that was my parents and my sister, and that was it as a child, except for, you know, the occasional times when they would drop in at another coach or a sort of pop-up academy at some public park. So it was a very, you know, extreme choice that the parents made to give their children this very unusual childhood in pursuit of this long shot tennis dream. And as far as the sisters between each other went, on the tennis court at least, Mari, being 18 months older and probably a little bit more focused early on, really was the better player for a long time. Naomi said that, you know, she leads their head-to-head record like a million to something, basically, because they would just play against each other. They didn't have other kids to play with a lot of times. And Mari was always winning. And that determination actually to beat Mari is what made Naomi into the player she is in a lot of ways. She had this older sister who was always a little better than her. It was always driving her to be even better and to improve so she could beat her sister. And that's something actually Mari didn't have. Mari didn't really have someone she could measure herself against, because her practice partner in Naomi was never as good as her. So it kind of gave Naomi this advantage, interestingly, that she could sort of slingshot herself past Mari once she finally beat her, which is a big moment in Naomi's life after years. I mean, she only beat her when she was 15 or 16. It really did take quite a long time to beat Mari at last. And she did. And yeah, and then their careers went opposite directions from there pretty quickly. Naomi passed Mari in the rankings, was having stronger results. And Naomi obviously eventually wins Grand Slam titles and gets to be number one in the world. And Mari's ranking tops out at 280 in the world, was her career high. And most of it was below that, obviously, that's her high. Most of it was in the 300s or maybe even 400s in the rankings. And it, you know, it's obviously a schism within the family in terms of their past. They had the two daughters had all the same sacrifices, all the same dreams, all the same ambition, all the same, you know, uprooted lives for tennis. And for one of them, it paid off hugely. And she's a superstar who people know as a household name. The other one doesn't have any of that, except for the sort of proximity of being the sister of the person who made it, which has its own tensions. So yeah, I like having Mari in this book a lot, actually, just for kind of showing, because I feel like so often in these sports biographies or any kind of biographies are almost always of successful people of some kind. It's helpful showing that's really not the reality. There's a lot more Maris in the world than there are Naomis. A lot more people try for things and don't get there and don't make it, but still, you know, had all their focus and their lives put around this dream.
And did you actually talk to Mari for the book?
Yes, Mari I talked to, for sure. And Mari was, again, same with who I hadn't spent as much time with because she wasn't on tour. I talked to her at the one tournament she played. She got a special invitation, a wild card, to play the Miami tournament in 2019, because her sister is number one in the world and they thought it would be an attraction. And it was. I mean, I was writing for the New York Times at the time, and we did an article about Mari playing her first tournament. And there was a full, she was on a side court, but it was very full. People just curious to see what the sister of the number one was playing like. So it was natural attraction there. So I did talk to her then. And I talked to her quite a bit for this book as well. And she was, again, super, the same kind of very revealing, very honest about her feelings and her upbringing and all sorts of stuff. She didn't want to talk about Naomi herself too much. She doesn't like talking about Naomi because she, as a lot of family members of celebrities are conscious of that. But certainly on her own story and her own view of her upbringing, she was very open.
And did you detect, Ben, any bitterness? I mean, it's a very poignant story. This is where the story really radically departs from the story of the Williams sisters, who are obviously a different kind of phenomenon. So did you get a sense that there was regret in Mari that she had never been able to achieve what her sister achieved?
For sure. I mean, I think she's disappointed she wasn't the tennis player she dreamed of being. I mean, she had the same dreams of being a Grand Slam champion and number one. And for herself, she was driven by a lot of the same things Naomi was, which was providing for her family, you know, and giving, making, paying her parents back for their sacrifice. Mari had all of that and still had that guilt. Even after Naomi had started making millions of dollars, she said, I was the oldest one. I felt like I should have been providing for the family. And that was tough for her to not feel like she achieved that goal or made their sacrifice worth it. So that was tough for her. I think in terms of tennis overall, I think she's still kind of wrestling with that. I don't think, I mean, she's only, you know, herself, I think 28 years old now. I think she's still trying to figure out where, or she turns 28 later this year, rather. I think that she is still trying to sort of come to peace or terms with how her life was shaped by tennis and this dream and by her parents and in this extreme way, and her relationship with tennis and how she feels about the sport kind of fluctuates up and down. And yeah, she's still coming to peace with that, or trying to find peace with that in a lot of ways, which again is a common thing in tennis. There's a lot of players, even ones who make it as on some level higher than Mari as a professional, you know, when it's all over, you know, what do you do with the rest of your life? It doesn't always, sometimes you're cut out to be a coach, but that's kind of limited career choice. And a lot of times, yeah, you don't feel like you're very well prepared and you feel like you missed out on a lot. And again, the Mari experience, I'm glad it's in the books. I think it has some resonance, hopefully, for people who, you know, any kind of sibling relationship, and then also people who just things don't go how they planned.
Absolutely. But as you say, in a funny kind of way, she's lucky at least that this chapter has come to a close at a time when she can start a whole new life at 28. It's not too late.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what one person is quoted saying, like, you know, you're lucky you had this realization at 26 when she actually retired. Do the rest of your life. It's pretty great. Not everyone figures it out that early.
That's absolutely right. Let's talk about Naomi's cultural identity, her sense of cultural identity, and her decision to play for Japan, not the US, where, as you say, she trained so intensively. That decision at the time, she was accused of it being a monetary move. Can you just give us a sort of outline of the motives in terms of rankings and what you think her thinking was?
I think the decision really was her father's, first of all, who made the decision for her. It wasn't Naomi's decision when she was a teenager and first started playing tournaments. When you first sign up for a tournament that's officially a sanctioned tournament, you have to pick a country, and only one country. No more, no less than one. So you had to pick one. And Naomi was a dual citizen of Japan and the U.S. She'd been born as a U.S. citizen because her father had emigrated to the U.S. from Haiti and had U.S. citizenship. So she was born, and both her sister were born as U.S. citizens, even though they were born in Japan through their father. So yeah, when it first came time, they were listed as Japan. And I think part of that, there were a bunch of different factors in that, but then they did wrestle with it for quite a while too. They were entertaining offers and invitations and temptations from the US Federation who wanted them to come over for years, including after Naomi even actually started playing her first couple matches on the WTA tour. The USTA was very interested in her and hadn't been interested previously because she wasn't a super promising child as a player. She didn't have the strongest results. She wasn't even the best in her family, as I said, and she was not someone who was really on the USTA radar. And so they hadn't offered her a ton of coaching or support or prizes or, you know, money, all the sorts of things that they sometimes offer their most promising children, boys and girls on tennis. So she hadn't gotten that, which maybe caused some resentments among the family as well. It's a pretty common theme in people who are overlooked by the USTA, the US Tennis Association, and any sort of big country or small country where there's a federation who has to, you know, have chosen players to back. They can't back everybody. They don't have the resources to do that, even a big country like the US. So yeah, so Japan, she had this option, and there had been this player, Kei Nishikori, who was a Japanese man who was working his way into the top, towards the top 10, let's say, and even before he hit the top 10, he was already getting tons of money in sponsorship and endorsements and was one of the highest paid celebrities in the world, and not just tennis players, but he was sort of in the top 100 at times, up there with people, rock stars like Ed Sheeran or Maroon 5, or else Kei Nishikori, who not a lot of people have heard of, probably outside of tennis fans or Japanese people, was right up there in terms of his earning because there had been so little success in especially men's tennis in Japan before that. And they had the Olympics coming up in 2020. So a lot of brands were wanting to get on board with Kei Nishikori to secure him as a possible face of the Olympics. And that was a success that Naomi's first agent and her family were definitely aware of and definitely was a factor. And then the Japanese Tennis Association, their federation, did offer some support and some invitations to Japanese tournaments as well. So it was back and forth, but it very much was a fluid thing. And this is something that we've seen actually a lot in the US, that there's a lot of Americans of various multicultural backgrounds, especially Asian Americans, who have chosen to represent the Asian country instead of their ancestral homeland of one or both of their parents, because the U.S. is a big pond, as I said, 300 something million people, a lot of tennis players among them, and it could be very easy to be lost in the shuffle. But for a lot of these smaller Asian countries, less tennis history or success, and Japan's not a small country by any definition in terms of population, over 100 million people as well, but there'd be less competition for Naomi. Naomi could pretty quickly become the best woman in Japanese tennis, and that had a lot more spotlight available than if she'd been in the U.S. and been behind not only the Williams sisters, who were still active at this point, but also all the various other American prospects. So there was certainly, her agents and past coaches have said, a financial calculation that was made, which is, I think, people can get cynical about that, but also people, you know, migrate to all countries and for better financial opportunities all the time. And yeah, it was something that she was comfortable with. She liked Japan. She had her grandparents there. She visited there a few times. She felt like her personality or being shy sort of matched Japanese culture. There were certain, she liked the food, something, you know, she liked watching anime shows and Pokemon and all sorts of stuff like that. And those things were meaningful to her. The thing that became a struggle for her once she actually got on tour and started representing Japan was the language issue, is that she did not speak fluent Japanese comfortably at all. She could speak some with her mom and knew some phrases, and often she and her mom would kind of switch back and forth between English and Japanese in the house, but she wasn't comfortable doing it sort of in on the record media appearances, which can be intimidating for anyone, even in their first language. And so for her in Japanese, that was tricky. So,
yeah, I thought that was interesting, Ben, because it seemed to me that without you saying so explicitly, I kind of got the inference maybe in your book that, okay, so she didn't speak it fluently enough to handle it at press conferences when there were Japanese media asking her questions, but she didn't actually go out of her way to correct that by learning it. She didn't think somewhere in the tour on the circuit, yeah, I am going to do a Duolingo course, or I'm going to get myself a tutor and I'm going to astonish everybody so that the next time this happens, I can deal with it.
So she did briefly, I think I do have a sentence mentioning that in the book. She did in late 2016 have a tutor, okay, I think, and was taking lessons and did start the 2017, which is her sort of second full season on tour, trying to do press conferences in Japanese when that season started. And what happened basically was fairly quickly in that season, there were some headlines or some quotes that came out, things she'd said that wasn't what she intended to say. You know, she was picking her words imprecisely, as a lot of people do in a second language. And she was frustrated by that and just didn't feel like the risk of, or discomfort of speaking in Japanese to accommodate this, you know, media market that she was representing was worth it to her. She felt more authentic being in English. And so she switched to this mode after that of getting questions in Japanese and spoken Japanese from the Japanese media and then answering in English. And her comprehension of the Japanese is pretty perfect. I mean, almost never does she need anyone to repeat anything in press, or does she give an answer that isn't what they were asking. I mean, she really is. It's interesting how the brain works in that way, but she can really understand and process this language very well. And it's great for me as a reporter, because a lot of times, you know, if there's, as an English speaking reporter who doesn't speak any Japanese, I should say, because, you know, if let's say Novak Djokovic is in press and he's doing the first two thirds of his press conference in English and then the last third in Serbian, I don't get anything out of the Serbian. But because Naomi is answering in English, it's almost like bonus time in the press conference. Because you can almost always tell what the question was based on the answer, and she's and still says interesting things even in the Japanese parts.
When she's in Japan and when she's facing Japanese fans, is she treated differently?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. It's complicated, and it kind of has fluctuated at times in her career, because she has had these ups and downs in her career and things that made her feel more or less connected to Japan various times in her career. And also a lot of her career was during the pandemic too. So for example, she played the Tokyo Olympics and was one of the faces of the Tokyo Olympics, but unfortunately had to do the cauldron lighting in the opening ceremony and the matches she played in the tennis competition in front of empty stands. So that was a huge disappointment for her and her career, and for Japanese fans, I'm sure, too, who wanted to celebrate her. So she hasn't had as many of the big rapturous moments as you might expect for a Japanese superstar to have had. And also Japan didn't host tournaments for a couple of years because of the pandemic as well, and around some of the peak of her popularity. But when she has played there, she's definitely been very warmly embraced and popular. Maybe not the same kind of, as you're saying, sort of, you know, really fanatical, rabid fandom that some of the mostly male, honestly, celebrities get in Japan, and the more homogeneously ethnically Japanese men specifically. Even athletes like Nishikori, and there's a baseball star now named Shohei Ohtani, who's a big star in Japan. I think they get kind of more classic rock star treatment a lot of times than maybe Naomi gets, but I don't know how much of that is her different background, is the lack of language skills, is her being a female athlete, which is obviously a less proven category in a lot of societies in terms of celebrity than male athletes, even still. So it's not quite the same level of impassionedness, but it's certainly warm. I mean, she certainly gets fans with signs and people cheering for her and everything. And so it's not bad at all, but it maybe is not always the same maximum intensity that you see sort of from the way that they react to their pop stars.
So let's talk about her Black identity and how she relates to her Haitian heritage, because she has integrated that in her life, in her political stance on Black Lives Matter, in a very front and center way. How did that come about? Was that sudden with her confrontation with this violence that she had a response to, or had she always been interested in her Blackness?
She's always been interested, and she's always been aware of it, just because it's how people see her when she's walking, anywhere in the U.S. especially. And her father certainly, too, is seen as a Black man in the U.S., as is her sister. She and her sister are Black women or Black girls when they were younger, obviously. And one of the things that happened in her childhood was in Florida, several hours north of where she lived in Florida, but still in Florida, was the shooting of Trayvon Martin, who was a Black teenage boy who was killed in sort of a skirmish with a sort of vigilante named George Zimmerman. Mm. And she was really shook by that as a child, having this person be murdered in this very racially charged thing for her made her very nervous and scared. And so that was background she'd had her whole life. And so when the stoppage happened in 2020 and she sort of started thinking about things more and wanted to be more outspoken. And then the murder of George Floyd happened in Minnesota. It was a moment for her to sort of take ownership of this part of her identity as well. And this kind of shifted. I think a lot of times early in her career, as I said, she was pivoting towards Japan. She was trying to sort of prove her Japaneseness. She was embracing the Japanese culture. She was wearing Japanese designers, things like that, different sorts of things, which were, not inauthentic. She did like those things and care about those things. And she is legitimately Japanese. Her mother's Japanese. She was born there. She understands the language and has a real actual affinity for that culture. But she has this other part of her as well that's also hugely there and is a part of her lived experience. And Mari as well. Mari says similar things about, being Black in America. Those are experiences they have, right? And those were things that were especially activated or touched upon, let's say, during the summer of 2020 with everything was going on and the protests and the turmoil. So that was her sort of stepping out and claiming that part of herself more publicly. In her statement when she stopped play in that Cincinnati tournament, she said something along the lines of, "Before I'm a tennis player, I'm a Black woman." She sort of identified herself that way and claimed that identity, which no one was really refuting. It was different for people in Japan, actually. Japan was sort of, people in Japan were unfamiliar with the Black Lives Matter movement, largely, and sort of police protest, violence as a concept and protests that were not something they'd really thought much about. So there was a cultural barrier there, but she fit pretty neatly into a sort of American framework of that. And Black people in America very readily embraced her, as they kind of always had. I think they saw her, from the moment they first met her, a lot of which was when she played Serena Williams in the 2018 US Open final, was when she kind of got mainstream attention. And obviously that match became a huge brouhaha with the dispute between Serena and the umpire. Black people early on, cultural commentators, whoever, saw Naomi as Black right away and recognized her that way and understood what her experience would be and her affinity for Serena. Also, she was very clearly in this, built in the model of the Williams sisters, who were obviously a hugely successful and famous and iconic Black family in the U.S. So, her Blackness was never really scrutinized by Black people in the same way that her Japaneseness was probably scrutinized by or pondered by Japanese people and also even people who were not Japanese. You know, Americans would sort of squint and look and say, are you really Japanese? Like, and sort of, you know, and sort of wrestle with that in a way that her blackness was less arguable. And so, you know, she does have this pivot in her life when she, in 2020, when she starts talking more about the black side of things and wearing more black designers and going to protest herself. And the Haitian side of her blackness as well became something that she was even more inspired by. Her father was Haitian, and that's obviously a very unique history that Haiti has as a, people don't know, as a sort of slaves who overthrew their captors and their colonizers in the French in Haiti, or Saint-Domingue at that time. And that sort of, and when she'd first gone to Haiti a couple of times, she didn't go there until she was an adult. She didn't go there until 2017 when she was 19 or 20 years old. And so that was, for her, was something that originally she had sort of been inspired by thinking about how, oh, these Haitian people don't have anything. You know, I should be grateful for what I have, and the sort of poverty there. And she did play really well that next season after that, was her breakthrough season after first going to Haiti. But then with time, I think she also drew more strength from the Haitian history, the sort of story of empowerment and the highlights of the Haitian history in terms of the self-actualization of this rebellion they'd had and the freedom they found and this unique way they fought for themselves and were stubborn in that way. And she found strength in that instead. And so that was something that she mentioned.
And she's also, I think she's given some money, hasn't she, to Haitian causes?
Yes, there's a school that her father has helped operate in his hometown or near his hometown of Jacmel in Haiti. Sort of named Asaka Foundation, yeah, has done some work there.
The big romance in your book is her relationship with Serena. Everything pales by comparison. She is her idol. She is her role model. And the relationship is one of total adulation. I found this at times, when I was thinking about it afterwards, slightly immature. So there's an example where I think she refers to Serena as her mother.
And tennis mom, yeah. Yeah.
Tennis mum, yes. And you think, well, you've already got a mother. You don't need another mother. This is not your mother. You know, so could you now, with the benefit of hindsight and a bit of distance from the book, now that you're out in the world talking about it, but you're not writing it, could you characterize or describe what you think this is all about between them? Is it just total Japanese-style hero worship?
Yeah, it's part of it. And maybe, and you know, Naomi is also a huge fan of other pop icons like Beyonce and Rihanna. You know, she does have, does venerate these superstar women in her life. Nicki Minaj a bit as well, probably. And she has, yeah. And so, but it's more profound than that with Serena. I mean, really, as I said, Naomi was an infant when her father saw Serena on TV and said, I'm going to make you into that, right?
Yes.
And so it's really... Serena was chosen for her in a lot of ways and has this profound impact on her life. And that's why it is this type deep, unwavering connection, which is especially strong and remarkable and unlikely, let's say, after the 2018 US Open final, where I think a lot of people expected, after this match where Serena has this, you know, long derailing argument with the officials about the rules violations, and the crowd starts booing. It's this really hostile, nasty environment, and it really does overshadow, in many ways, Naomi's win of her first Grand Slam title. I think almost everyone expected Naomi to resent Serena or to hold that against her, or to have to fall out of love with Serena, to use your sort of romantic framing, which I like. I do think that it's a sort of, yeah, that Serena is the...
It's like a bromance, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is like,
yeah,
a bromance.
It's a female bromance, whatever that is. But Naomi was unshaken by that. And maybe it would have been easier for her to process some things, maybe, if she had been able to blame Serena for it, but she never... has ever said anything publicly or privately that I've ever heard about blaming Serena for that.
She's been happy to say that she's happy to lose to her, that it's an honor to lose to her.
Yeah, there's this moment. Yeah, exactly. So it goes both ways, because the next time they played after that US Open final was in Canada, and it was the one match where I'm pretty sure Naomi didn't want to win, and she kind of tanked and played this very passive match, and Serena was very motivated because Serena had lost to Naomi twice at this point, and Naomi loses very meekly in this match to Serena. And then she comes back and beats her in 2021 Australian Open semifinals in their final match. And Naomi has a great record against Serena, one of the best records ever. Only four matches, but she won three of them. And she's, you know, one of only two players ever to have a winning record against Serena, having played at least, I think, three times, something like that is the stat. So she is, yeah, but she's deferential to Serena. She's still, you know, one of the more interesting things for her as I was as writing this book in 2022, which was a very mediocre year for Naomi when really her motivation was really flickering in the sport. What she seemed more interested in the late part of that season was Serena's retirement tour. That Serena was officially retiring. Naomi was going to her matches, sitting in the stands or sitting somewhere up where people, the top people couldn't see her. Just wanted to be watching Serena again, like a fan. And again, to have still have retained this very, in many ways, fanish relationship with this person or adoration of this person while you are their rival and beating them is super unusual. Yeah, usually, almost always, there's I mean, it's not common for a player to have someone they idolize and get to play them on tour if they're, you know, the ages, if the person lasts long enough on tour. There's other situations like that. But actually, I can say they weren't, it wasn't the same kind of degree of idolization. But Sloane Stephens was another player, another African-American player who came and challenged Serena about 5 years before Naomi did. And they had a very tense relationship once Sloane first beat her. And it was very frosty. And Serena did not enjoy Sloane. And Sloane made sort of comments in press about how rude Serena was. And people didn't realize how, you know, how mean she really is. And that turned sour very quickly. And actually, I had a section on that I cut from the book. There's a lot of stuff I cut from the book for length. But there were these examples of other relationships going awry. And Serena didn't always take kindly to people coming up and being younger and beating her, obviously. So Naomi was unique, though, in that way. And Naomi also always stayed on Serena's good side in this way that was unique. And Naomi couldn't imagine it any other way, too. But that was not contrived. That was authentic from Naomi.
Authentic, but I would still describe it as a kind of deference. And when you just mentioned that moment of her father saying, "I am going to make you into that," it's almost like saying, "I am going to make you, a human, into that goddess." I mean, it's like Serena is on an entirely other plane. And I do think that the relationship is reliant on a dynamic of worship, which even when Naomi wins, is never really changed into something else. It doesn't convert.
Yeah. And when Naomi was encountering Serena on court in their matches was at a time when Serena, goddess, to use that word, representation or framing was at its peak. I mean, there were all these ad campaigns calling her goddess, or she wore a Nike outfit that had, it was in French, so Deus or whatever, goddess in French, written on the jacket or something, and queen or whatever else. And it was she, and there are lots of campaigns calling her queen and similar language people use to Beyonce. I've referred to this sort of, not in the book, I don't think I use this word, but the sort of Beyoncification of Serena, where she had been made into this sort of flawless, you know, pop star goddess person. And Serena's a lot more complicated and in this much more fraught competitive world than Beyonce at this point of her career, over the last 10 years of her career, has been very controlled. Everything's very, obviously she does live shows, but everything's very choreographed and rehearsed. And whereas Serena is throwing herself into the arena, you know, into competition, people trying to derail her, trying to disrupt her. And it's a lot more complicated with officials and rules and all these things that Beyonce doesn't have chair umpires at her concerts. So it's a lot more messy for Serena in a lot of ways, and a lot more human and more compelling. Not that Beyonce is not compelling, but
careful what you say there.
but Naomi definitely sees Serena largely authentically buys into a lot of this framing of Serena as, you know, flawless goddess queen. And that is telling of how a lot of the cultural framing was, a lot of which was corrective and maybe an overcorrection for how the Williams sisters were ostracized in the beginnings of their careers in the US and worldwide. People trying to make amends for that. I do think at times it certainly was an overcorrection. Some of it was over the top. I think they would agree with that. But it did come from this place of, you know, as Black Lives Matter was going on in parallel at different phases and, you know, different other cultural events in America and the world, trying to celebrate them in this way that was remedial to try to make up for past slights or wrongs.
Now, if I've sort of exaggerated what I'm calling this kind of girl bromance thing between Naomi and Serena, the flip side of that is that when it comes to Naomi's private life and her actual partner, you don't quote him, and he's very much below the radar, and yet he is the father of Naomi's child. Mm-hmm. I don't get a sense of him being on the circuit with her. I get the sense that she goes to be with him when he's on tour. So he remains quite shadowy in the book.
Yeah, he does. does. And that's a somewhat conscious choice. Again, just picking, the book is long. I would have mentioned that. The book is like 450 pages long. And so Corday, I've never met Corday, actually. I that's one person I did not have a great contact with. I did reach out to him and his team at some point. I did, went to one of his concerts, actually, when he was playing near my hometown of Washington. And it was an interesting relationship they have. But Corday has not been a big part of her career in a lot of ways. He's an interesting presence that he kind of drifts in and out of the picture a lot of times. He doesn't travel on tour with her almost ever. I think he's been to the US Open twice, and I think that's it in terms of his tournaments that he goes to, which is not a lot. Naomi, when there were lulls in the tour, especially in 2022, when she was feeling less motivated to tennis, she was on tour with him for a few stints of a week or two at a time. Not too long on the tour bus either, but a couple times where she would go with him there. So yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing. There's a certain segment of hip hop fans to whom Naomi is best known as Corday's girlfriend, who will probably be not as satisfied with this book because they want more Corday. But you know, there are times when he has influence on her that I do talk about in the book for sure. Like, he was someone who, I think during the summer of 2020 and the Black Lives Matter stuff, he was already much more political. He was already someone who studied a lot of Black history, read a lot of books, and he was giving Naomi books to read. I think, was a driver of them going to Minnesota for the protest. He went with her to the protest. That was without telling her team at all, her tennis team, her family, that they were renting this private plane mid-pandemic to go to these protests in Minnesota, which is probably a 4-hour flight away from Los Angeles, not a close by place. So yeah, he's there, and he's been part of her independence in a lot of ways. You know, she goes fairly quickly from living with her parents to living in Los Angeles and meeting him. So it is sort of a new foundation she had. But at the same time, he is in and out. You know, the relationship is off and on, also as part of it too. Bluntly, when I was writing the book, I wasn't sure what the status of the relationship would be when the book came out. So I didn't want to make him too foregrounded as part of it. But yes, he is obviously a big part of her life and the father of her child. And they seem to be on good terms now.
Okay. Now, one of the big themes of the book, obviously, is Naomi's mental health. Her mental health has been up and down. She's been very open about it. It's commonly described as depression. And yet, I wanted to ask you, Ben, given the way it manifests in terms of her ease at crying in public, she cries very readily, I wondered whether it is depression, or is that self-diagnosed? Is it mood swings? Do we know any more about what it is that's actually going on with her?
I don't want to diagnose her myself too much, but I do think it is self-diagnosed, and that's the term she's used for herself, is feeling depressed and having experienced depression and, you know, repeated depression and times of depression, periods of depression, that she points to different points in her career, her life, that she can track these onto. One of the things with Naomi in the book, and this is kind of how the first chapter starts, is there's this disconnect between her public face, especially in, you know, around 2021 when she withdrew from the French Open around mental health concerns that she cited, and becoming this face of mental health in the US or in the world, really, in the media and at the Olympics in Tokyo that year, versus not actually getting a lot of formal help. You know, she was on magazine covers about mental health, but wasn't seeing a therapist. Right. And so there was
that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. That's so interesting that you mentioned that.
So that's where I think we're on the same wavelength, or you led me there for sure. So that is something, that is, like, for some people can make her face of that certainly feel hollow, or feel like it's not the right person to be leading a conversation, let's say, about mental health, maybe rather than being hollow. And I did talk to someone who's a traveling psychologist, one of the other top players on tour, Iga Świątek, who's the current women's number one. She is a full-time or nearly full-time traveling psychologist with her, named Daria Abramovic. And Abramovic was saying that, you know, it can be irresponsible to have, you know, public health advice given out by celebrities who aren't trained or qualified in these arenas and with this language to be the ones dishing out these things. So yes, it's a complicated thing. But, you know, I think anyone who knows Naomi knows that the struggles are real, that the ups and downs are real, and that, you know, the emotions are complicated and can be strong and severe, and don't doubt that she's having mental health struggles, right? But if she's, yes, in terms of diagnoses, they're often probably not sort of, you know, what would be classic DSM kind of diagnoses of clearly defined medical or psychological terms.
That's what I wondered, particularly since, you know, in this era now, we know so much more about the sort of support teams around players. And one of the things that obviously we're very aware of in Australia is the work that Ash Barty has done with Ben Crowe around motivation and positive psychology and having a kind of very sane, holistic, healthy attitude to this completely insane world that you're part of. So why would someone like Naomi, who clearly is very vulnerable to her emotions, not go and find someone and add them to the mix of her support team?
I mean, there's lots of people in the world who I think don't get always seek the right help that they need. And people, you know, it's not always as automatic as, you know, even people. And athletes, I think, too, are probably more strong with this, are taught to not show weakness, to tough things out, to be stronger and to push through. And that's a kind of coding that other athletes have talked about having to shake off when they do have these moments of struggle, mental or even physical. Otherwise, you know, if they're having their bodies breaking down and they keep pushing through, the pain can lead to worse outcomes physically or mentally. So for Naomi, and also Naomi also, as I've said several times, and with her upbringing, she's just also super shy. It's not easy for her raising conversations and saying, I need help, or I want to reach out to someone, or even, you know, probably the actual experience of opening up to a stranger in the form of a therapist wouldn't be something that she'd be naturally inclined to do, wouldn't be something that she'd be comfortable doing right away. So there are these impediments to it. But at the same time, she does know, I think on some intellectual level, that it's important, something she should be doing, but it's still a struggle to get this going. And I guess where it's sort of surprising, I guess, is that all these are relatable human, you know, things and reluctances and imperfections, you want to say. At the same time, she is, you know, shouldering this increasingly huge business empire and this team and these expectations and these people working for her. And yet still, she can still be this sort of, as the boss of this team, ultimately, or CEO. And certainly when it comes to her mental health, she's the one making the decisions. In the end, she can still be shakier than you'd expect, and things can wobble in this way for her, and despite all of the people and money attached to her.
And it is interesting that despite what you say, she is quite open in press conferences about saying, yes, I'm depressed, or yes, I don't quite understand why I reacted that way and why I cry so easily. And in fact, she'll cry at the press conferences themselves. You devote a lot of time in the book to Naomi's social media presence and her engagement with social media and the way she speaks at press conferences. So you give us transcription and direct quotation of long, slightly rambling paragraphs where she's kind of stumbling her way through an answer. And I guess that this is representational of the changing of the guard to a generation who grew up with social media and whom this is a constant presence. But she does seem to have been quite enthusiastic in embracing, well, what was Twitter when she joined it and which is now X. Do you think that that's a healthy release valve for her? Can you comment on how you think she uses social media?
Yeah, this goes back to her childhood again, that she said in her first interview that she called herself a child of the internet and the internet had raised her. This had been her social output into a wider world beyond these three people in her immediate family, her mother, father, and sister. The internet was how she found people to talk to, or even just read or read jokes or watch videos and find a socialization that she didn't have from a normal school or anything like that. So the internet was something she was very comfortable with. And a lot of her boldest statements, even throughout her career, that weren't in interviews, have come from social media. You know, when she did her on her phone, let's say, when she did her statement against the press conferences at the French Open, when she did her statement saying she wasn't going to play during the Black Lives Matter summer 2020, those were things she wrote on her phone and increasingly with some, you know, agent oversight. It wasn't all as organic as it looks and as, you know, casual as it looks with the screenshot of the phone app. Those can be, especially the one where she pulled out of the French Open and gave the statement, that was much more manicured and looked at by agents and other advisors at times. Although Naomi did have the final say in it. Yeah, it's a huge part of knowing who she is. And this is for her generation, this is the outlet, you know, this very authentically where she feels comfortable, where she speaks now. You know, she's now on this new social media app, Threads, which is the Instagram version or the Meta version of Twitter now. And she's on there a bit in recent weeks, actually. And she's saying she's kind of finding her voice there again. And she still has this sort of musings thing. And a lot of that can come from, you know, again, her often limited social network that still is not, she doesn't have a huge circle of close friends. She has employees who she does like a lot of and talked about certain things, but doesn't have a huge network of friends now. And so she'll, you know, she was asking, you know, on threads recently for, you know, dental advice, something about she'd got, wanted to get some sort of, she said her teeth had gotten spaced out from pregnancy and she was wondering about getting them restraightened and was asking about that. And so this, you know, huge superstar person just going on musing on social media like anyone else is, you're shaking your head, but it's remarkably, it's relatable in a certain way. And it's a great resource, you know, as a biographer. You know, I don't have this person's diaries or letters like you might have writing about for some 19th century person, but for Naomi, and a lot of, it was tricky on social media technically because a lot of things that, or technologically, because a lot of things that she posts get deleted later, she takes down, or some things on certain social media are temporary. So archiving that was a challenge as a biographer, historian at times. But yeah, it was it's definitely a place where she feels comfortable and where her generation lives. I don't think you can sort of tell the story of Naomi Osaka without having a, as a biographer, without having a working understanding of social media and how to index it and how to transport it into book.
Yeah, it adds another sort of layer of texture to the narrative. And I completely get why you do it, because it is emblematic, as you say, of her generation. Now, one of the other aspects of the book that I think is really fascinating and is kind of like the invisible section of the iceberg to most of us is her wealth and her influence in terms of money and the relationships that she has with her sponsors. I wanted to ask you, how much influence does a major sponsor have on a career at the elite end in terms of determining what you do, which tournaments you're part of, what other things you're associated with? I mean, can you just tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly there are pressures. And I'll talk about a typical tennis player first. I mean, certainly a lot of tennis players will have contracts that will have minimums. Like, for example, like a clothing sponsor is maybe the most obvious one. So Nike for Naomi or other players will often have a minimum number of tournaments you have to play in order to get paid for your annual full rate for your clothing deal, and especially a minimum number of Grand Slam tournaments. There were some rumors actually when Serena was making her retirement tour that she was trying to hit minimums by playing two Grand Slams in 2022 to try to, I don't know if that was true, but that was something people within the tennis business speculated about because they knew how those contracts worked, that, okay, she's coming back to play five tournaments and we're sort of, they were maybe four, whatever. They were doing the math on what money Serena might get by making this certain number of appearances she was choosing to make. And again, I don't know that Serena was doing it for those reasons, but people, agents were saying this could be to meet certain obligations. And certainly there are forces, you know, I think they call them in the book, you know, centripetal forces that kind of keep you on this, on the carousel in the sport and make it harder to stop at times when, yeah, there are these minimums, when there are certain things. And also there's not just number of minimum tournaments, but there's ranking minimums. Nike especially is known for paying players very prorated amounts based on their ranking. So you get a lot of money if you're number one, a good amount of money if you're number five, you know, less top 10. And then if you're not top 100, I think for certain Nike contracts, they don't pay you at all.
So there are bonuses which accrue to your position.
Incentives, exactly. Okay. And that goes for racket manufacturers as well. Bonuses, certainly, like, you know, someone wins a Grand Slam, they'll get bonus checks and pretty significant amounts of money from that. So that's all pretty standard. For Naomi, though, what was interesting for her is that she really startled, I think, her sponsors on several different occasions in her careers by doing things to disrupt this normal plan, this normal schedule. In that, you know, certainly when she stopped play at the sort of first real disruptive moment in the 2020 New York bubble, as a protest we've mentioned several times, that was jolting for sponsors, especially the Japanese sponsors who were a big part of her portfolio, especially at that time, who hadn't signed up to be representing, you know, an activist or a disruptor. They'd wanted to represent this shy, friendly champion Japanese girl in their minds. And that was something that they had to adjust to. And even honestly, even on social media in the months before that, when she was speaking out and saying more pointed things and more provocative things, let's say, that was something that already she sort of knew. She made a joke at something like, my agent gets so nervous whenever I open the Twitter app, something like that, she said. And that's definitely true. And then, yeah, when she stopped playing and started talking about mental health, a lot of brands were surprised with that. A lot of them also saw it as a big opportunity, you know, to sort of be, because Naomi, what she was saying was really resonating with a lot of people and was finding a lot of coverage and audience. And they were sort of saying, hey, we can, some of the brands, not all, but some of them were saying, hey, we can use this. We can benefit from this. Yeah. We can find value in this in a cynical way in their meetings. And brands also with Naomi, this wasn't your question, but also Naomi got a lot of brand attention from a lot of brands who were trying to do corrective work of breaking their own images, especially during Black Lives Matter and the years that followed in the pandemic, especially where she was this young, Black, but diverse, multiracial woman. And so if you're a corporation that doesn't want to be seen as old, stodgy, white and male, that she was this perfect face to slap on your brand, and which raised her value a lot. And she was seen as sort of, old, you know, I think there's a New York Times headline, a quote that something like, why Naomi Osaka became everyone's favorite spokesperson, you know, that's early 2021, which is kind of the peak of her earning powers. Because, yeah, she was this mix of things that everyone
She ticked every box.
Exactly. And what I started to say about typical tennis contracts, Naomi actually and her agent, I don't know if this is in the book so much, actually, but Naomi and her agent negotiated certain contracts for her that wouldn't include some of the minimums from companies like Nike, that wouldn't require her to play a certain number of tournaments, that would give her a bit more flexibility than the standard sort of boilerplate contract might. And the other thing with her contracts is that there's also an issue, this is an epilogue, but around maternity leave, a lot of the companies, you know, obviously if you're off tour all year having a baby, you're not going to have any minimums. But, and that was a thing where a lot of athletes, especially some sports where they rely even more on sponsorship money and endorsement money than prize money or salary, like track and field athletics. There are certain female sprinters who lost all their income basically when they went on maternity leave. And so because of a high profile case in that in the US of a sprinter named Allison Felix with Nike, who had a dispute with them, learning from that example, Naomi's contract was written with maternity clauses in it already before she even got pregnant. So there were provisions in there before for this unforeseen pregnancy, let's say.
So she's about to become, is she not, the world's first billionaire athlete?
That was a goal of hers that she stated. Yeah, she's a goal that's in the book. Is she stated not like super like bold font, but it is that she had said that it was an ambition of hers that she started racking up this money and having these business ventures and entrepreneurship. And she started a skincare company and she did these other sorts of things that were kind of big plays towards becoming a mogul of some kind. She was, you know, she was making at her peak for a couple of years, she was making $50 or $55 million a year. So, you know, with conservative saving, that can get you to $1 billion. In what, 20 years time, if you keep that up, or roughly. But her earnings have tailed off a bit. She wasn't on tour at all last year, so she wasn't earning, you know, she's probably earning some estimates that she was earning somewhere between $15 and $20 million in 2023 without hitting a ball.
But what is she doing with the money? Does she have a strong philanthropic conscience?
So she has the foundation I mentioned in Haiti and her father's school there. That's the main source of her philanthropy at this point. And she has another venture that's partnered with Nike. But I'm not sure how much of her own money goes into it, honestly, called Play Academy, which is about getting girls involved in sports. And they operate both in Japan and in the US, I think, and in Haiti. I think all three of those countries are sort of three homelands. They have a footprint there, Play Academy. You know, and she has time too. I think that, you know, she's only 26. Like, I think that she, you know, she loved time. I think a lot of tennis players especially really see their window of earning is very limited, you know, because you certain point when you're in your 30s, usually, and sometimes before that, even if you're unlucky, your body will start slowing down and you'll stop earning money and you don't have the same earning potential at all. You know, most people in most careers make their most money probably in their 40s, 50s. And as they reach the higher parts of the ladder at their various companies, but for tennis players, it peaks very early. So not a lot of them are enormously big spenders or generous there. So Naomi, I think, I don't think she's spending most of her money. She does, you know, she has a fancy house but also sold fancy houses as well. So she does certain things that are spending some of that money, but not huge amounts of it. I don't have any sense that she's doing anything to bankrupt herself at this point.
Okay. So there's obviously an unclear future for her. We don't know what the next chapter of the Naomi Osaka life will be, both on court and how she will reinvent herself after that life. What about for you, Ben? As you say, this is a big book. You've invested a lot of time and energy in this book. Mm-hmm. Were you here during the Australian Open consciously scouting or following another player who interests you in the same way? Or is there a little bit of fallow time required before you get sparked enough to devote time again to another biography?
Yeah, I don't know what my next project will be, whether it be a biography or some other kind of book. I did enjoy doing a biography, and I'd not really thought of myself as a biographer before doing this book, but I would be interested in doing another biography. I think it's a format that I enjoy doing. And I think people will resonate with these life stories, as obviously your podcast can attest, hopefully. And yeah, I think that, you know, I would love to do something also beyond tennis. To answer your question, I don't have any immediate idea. I'm not working on anything at the moment. There is probably this fallow period. I did finish this book fairly recently, you know, only in less than, I don't know, the final draft of it and final revisions and everything only probably 4 months ago or five months ago, something like that. And it was pretty, because of her being very much a active public figure and young person and evolving and giving birth and all these things, it was keeping it timely was kind of down to the wire, and making sure that everything came into focus was not easy, as her career was kind of drifting in and out of motivation and things like that. So all that is to say, this book, yeah, took a lot out of me. I still feel like I'm catching my breath from it a bit and still a bit fallow for sure. But yeah, biography is definitely an interesting format to me. Like I said, I've done most of tennis in my life. I would be open to doing non-tennis subjects or books for sure. I think a lot of those skills would translate elsewhere. There's lots of other interesting stories in the world for sure. So we'll see. I'm open to the sparks whenever they come. I'm not certainly not shutting my eyes to sparks, but I have not caught that spark just yet.
Okay, well, rest up. You've earned it like a champion. Thank you very much for talking to me today, Ben Ruthenberg.
Thank you, Caroline. Appreciate it.
For some reason, tennis produces really good writing. The benchmark is still Andre Agassi's Open, a remarkable memoir of next-level candor about a life lived in public, on and off the court. But there is something about the sport itself, with its mental component and strategic play, and the fact that while you may be surrounded by a team of coaches, managers and others, ultimately you go out there on your own to face your opponent, who may be a friend off court, in gladiatorial combat. And that adds dimensions of psychology to the narrative. Thank you for listening to Life Sentences. The series is produced by David Roach for Two Heads Media and edited by Kira Jordan for Pipewolf Media. We live and work on Dharawal country. Music is composed and performed by Amanda Brown.